Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you, of course, by globalresearch.ca. And Ellen Brown is back for part two today. You were all listening yesterday, so you know who Ellen is. Ellen, before we start, I'd like to have my own commercial, if I could just take a moment. Well, I explained who this is brought to you by, and certainly Global Research and this program, the News Hour, are tied together like ham and eggs or whatever. This program is important. We began on Republic a little over a year ago, back in the winter of last year, early in the year, I believe in February. And we do the kind of things that, the kind of topics, the kind of guests that we bring on. You just don't get this in too many other places. You certainly never get it when you turn on your TV set, and you don't get this kind of information from the newspapers or publications that most people read, the ones with big subscriptions or circulations. I don't think they're doing as well as they used to. I think they're having a very hard time. They should have a hard time. I don't know why anyone wastes their money on the kind of material they put out. But we concentrate on vital topics, important issues, top guests like Ellen, giving listeners the kind of information they really need to know in our own self-defense. And we do it repeatedly, day after day after day. I know I myself started out wanting to host one program a week. Well, it seems to be going most every day of the week. And as long as I hold up, this is what I want to do and just keep going from topic to topic. Certainly the global economy and the situation we're in is crucially important, so we keep coming back to it all the time. And with Ellen, have a chance to talk about a system just mirror opposite of the one that we have, which is how we got into this problem in the first place. Oh, there's all kinds of ugliness behind it, and we're going to talk about some of it next week when Daniel Estulin comes on, and he's written about the Bilderbergers, who just had their meeting in Greece, and he got hold of, I don't know how he gets it, he got hold of a 73-page report on what they talked about. Apparently, there are people who get in there, and they're not happy about the ugly stuff that goes on in those meetings. They met for two or three days, but it's important to know that these people talk to each other all the time, so they may get together for a few days in Greece or wherever, and they want to keep it secret, but apparently they're less and less able to do it now. Oh, Ellen, welcome to the program, a truth hour, always a truth hour.
Thanks, Steven.
You mentioned a few things to me, and we can range over a lot of things. I thought maybe also in this hour we could talk about what you cover at the end of your book, a really people's-oriented banking system. And you control the money. You pretty much control everything. The money system of a country is like the blood in our veins. I mean, you have control of that. You literally can control everything that's going on, because if you shut it off, you just shut off the way a country can work. We'll go back to the way it was when we rubbed two sticks together and made fires or something like that. But you mentioned a few other things, too. One thing that really intrigued me, China stopping to buy our bonds. We have to take a break, but maybe you can mention something about that when we come back, because that would be pretty major. China, I guess, owns about as many of our bonds as anybody, China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they may not want to sell them, but if they stop buying them, that's big news.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a break, and I'm dying to hear what you may have heard. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown. Oh, tell me about China. Ellen, I'm dying to hear this. Do they CC you on their internal memos?
No, it's out in the regular news. It's in the investment newsletters. They're saying there's a big long-term bond yields are going up because China is no longer buying long-term bonds, the 30-year bonds. What they're buying instead are the short-term bonds because they're supposedly worried about our hyperinflating the money supply because we're running the printing presses, or our Federal Reserve is pumping money out there in the form of what they now call quantitative easing, but they used to call it running the printing presses when it was all done on a printing press. They're just pumping credit out there. So who is left to buy our long-term bonds? The Federal Reserve has stepped up and said they were buying $300 billion of them not too long ago, maybe a couple of 3 weeks ago, which everybody is worried is hyperinflationary, but I think that's a very good thing. That's what we should have been doing all along. We should buy it from our own central bank. And the reason is our Federal Reserve rebates the interest back to the government after they deduct their costs. So it's almost interest-free money to the government. It's the cheapest way we can fund our debt. It's almost like having the government issue the money itself. Now, it does matter what you're using this money for, but to the extent that they're using that $300 billion is obviously to fund actual government expenses as opposed to the other money that the Fed is creating. The part that they're creating to bail out the banks, to clean up the derivatives on their books, which are just gambling debts, could be dangerously hyperinflationary. But to the extent that they're creating money to create goods and services, to create infrastructure, and to replace the banking system that has collapsed, or the credit system that has collapsed, the credit freeze, to unfreeze the credit freeze, to get business going again, that's a good thing. And it's good that we're doing it through our central bank because that's the cheapest way we can get credit out there.
Well, you talk about in Web of Debt, the idea would be to have a government bank doing this. But the myth that printing money causes inflation, it's not so. It causes inflation if it's not used productively. But there's no problem printing, I would guess, any amount of money as long as it's used for productive purposes, goods and services, to grow the economy. And you cite the times in the past in our own country when this was done. We had no printing presses rolling it out back then. But money creation that was put into productive purposes. And what's going on now is you're talking about, and you write about, and I write about too. I mean, so much of this money is being created and just handed over to the bankers. So-called bailouts or handouts. And what bothers me even more, Ellen, is a lot of this stuff makes the news. But what's going on that doesn't make the news? And, I mean, what are these people doing? We know the big Wall Street banks own the Federal Reserve, so they can pretty much operate it any way they want to do it. And they have a stranglehold on the government and the U.S. Treasury. I almost don't see any difference between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve these days, do you?
No, it's a revolving door between the Federal Reserve and the big banks, or Goldman Sachs specifically lately. If you talk about inflation, if you look at those inflation charts, we've never had so much inflation as we've had since the Federal Reserve instituted it. It's an exponential curve. So what actually creates inflation is the way that money comes into existence today, which is through banks, because banks always put out less than they require back because they require interest to be paid out back. So continually somebody has to be taking out yet more loans in order to cover the interest on the old loans, which are our money supply. If money came into existence through the government as payment for goods and services, I mean, that's what money is, or what it was to the American colonists, was receipts for goods and services. So that money, once paid, would stay out in the money supply, but the goods and services are created as well. So you've got supply and demand going up together. And once you've got a stable money supply like that, you don't have to keep printing more money. You can recycle it. So, the way they did it in Pennsylvania was they lent most of the money into the system. But it was a government-owned bank, and so the money all came back to the government, and the interest came back to the government, and that was sufficient to pay the government's expenses, so they didn't have to pay taxes, and they could print a little extra to cover that interest. But you only had to print that sum once, principal and interest, lend your principal, spend your interest on government expenses, and then it all comes back as principal and interest. So it's a closed system. You don't have to keep expanding it.
Way back, Henry Ford, I've read the quote a few different ways, but the way I've read it most recently was that he talked about if people knew the way the money supply was manipulated, I guess, and by whom, we'd have a revolution tomorrow morning. Another way I saw the quote was something to the effect that if people knew a quarter of what is going on in the country, we'd have a revolution tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, in other words, if people really understand what the devil is going on, what our government is doing, not for us but to us, people simply wouldn't stand for it, which is the purpose of this program. If any day I don't show up, it probably means they've been listening and they came by and they shot me the night before. In that case, I will not be with you the next day. unless there's still an echo of the shotgun or whatever they might use.
But I actually think that the alternative media, I've heard it, read somewhere it was a leaderless revolution, the internet, because ideas just spread, and it's not obvious where they came from. It's just sort of like little antennas go up, and then they attract pools of interest around them. So it's not like where you have your leader that gets up on TV and says something that the whole world sees and judges and can take pot shots at. Somebody writes something or says something on, in this sort of closed media, and then it spreads because it's interesting.
Oh, it's so true, Ellen. You and I will put out an article, and it gets posted on one, two, whatever number of websites, and then others pick it up. And I think if we went back a few weeks later, we would be absolutely astonished at how many websites reposted what we wrote, and then people see that, and they may pass it on to others. We both get emails from people who say, so-and-so sent me this article that you did. I got one yesterday. And, this stuff just circulates. But I have to say, it's because the Internet potentially is a threat to the power structure, the power system, the corporations, and I think the government is looking for ways to take control of the Internet and do it in a way so as not to offend us. Because if they just grab it and turn it into a toll road and just outright censorship from one day to the next, there would be some serious reverberations. But they're very clever about the way they do nasty things to us. But I've written a little bit about this, not much, a little bit about it, that there really are things going on behind the scenes where the government and big corporations just want to shut down the Internet the way it is today. For the corporations to make all they can out of it, to turn it into a toll road, and for the government to censor content. So if they don't like a program like this, it doesn't go on the air. They just simply won't allow it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they don't like a website that posts the kind of material that Global Research posts, they'll shut it down. Well, heaven forbid if something like that happens, but it's something we need to think about and be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a race. We've got two things going on here. But I think that you do read, for instance, in the Bilderberg stuff that the money power may have precipitated this whole credit crisis, and I think there's a lot of evidence for that. But they sort of did it as a desperate move because they really are at the end of the line with their whole system. It can't be sustained. That derivative at over $250 billion is just not a sustainable system. So they had the only option they really had was to push it into crisis and then impose a police state or a totalitarian system all under one big central bank and one global treasury and so forth, which they're talking about the IMF being or the Bank for International Settlements. So And even among themselves, according to those reports from the Bilderbergers, they're concerned that they've gone too far and that they're not going to be able to recover from this. So they themselves, I think, they're probably more terrified than we are.
It may turn out that some of the smartest dudes around end up outsmarting themselves, Ellen. I've read a little bit, and we'll talk about it next week when Daniel Estulin comes on. But apparently, out of this meeting, there was some considerable disagreement, including those who are very scared that they have really unleashed the whirlwind, and they don't know how to put the genie back in the bottle.
Right,
and,
right.
I think the initial ideas that Estulin talked about that was posted online was a disagreement on whether they have a protracted, terrible depression,
yeah,
or maybe a short, a two-year terrible depression. And now they're not so sure, but they still talk about having a depression with a D. And the other stuff floating around is for a global currency, a global world government, a global world health organization, using the swine flu scare as a way to set that up. And, I mean, everything on a global basis and ending national sovereignty. I mean, the worst possible things that could happen to you, me, and everybody else.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Post on the Open Government Dialogue website, you titled it Take Back the Power to Create Money from the Private Banking Industry. Let me just read your closing line, and then it's a very short post. You talk about the economy is currently being crippled by a credit freeze caused by a failed private banking system. We can remedy the problem by setting up a public banking system to supplement and backstop the private system. Talk for a minute how the private system works and why it got us in all this trouble.
All of our money currently comes from banks in the form of loans, all of it, except for coins, which compose only about 1/10,000th of the money supply. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money, and that's the only thing Congress does. But in fact, in the colonies, the governments issued the money, and that's what we should return to, government-issued money. But meanwhile, we have a debt-based system, and it's the nature of a debt-based system that there's always more money owed than is even out there. And so that's why it's always inflationary and why people are always in debt, because you can't possibly get out of a debt at compound interest. If you just look at those graphs, you can see what the problem is. For instance, in 1971, when we went off the gold standard internationally, allegedly, Henry Kissinger went to the OPEC countries and said, I'm going to make you very rich. We're going to quadruple the price of oil. But in exchange, you will agree to sell your oil only in dollars, and you will deposit the money in our U.S. banks, our big Wall Street banks. So that forced all the countries, suddenly with the oil at four times the price it was, all these countries that needed oil had to borrow, and of course they had to borrow in dollars. And then they started this debt trap for third world countries. And then in 1980, Paul Volcker put the interest rate up as high as 20%. Well, if you look at one of those charts, at 20% interest, your debt doubles in 3 years and 10 months. So it's no wonder that third world countries can't escape the debt trap. For instance, the Philippines right now pays 80% of their revenues go to pay off foreign creditors. It's unbelievable. They have no money. And at one time, the Philippines had their own internally generated currency. That's what any country could do. Any state could do it. Any city could do it, could set up their own bank. Well, I'm in favor of setting up your own bank and dealing in Federal Reserve notes. Just deal in the national currency. But the other alternative, I saw that Latvia was talking about, they're so heavily in debt now that they were talking about paying, the government is talking about paying its employees in these warrants, you know, which are just basically coupons or receipts or IOUs, but they are a form of alternative currency. Well, that's a good thing. That's what they should be doing. Every country could have its own internal currency for all its internal things. And I would put the Chinese investors or officials' minds at rest that it's actually good for the country if the Federal Reserve steps in and replaces this, gets credit going again. Every country, you want credit to flow because you want business to be able to get back on its feet. So the Chinese themselves, I'm sure, are a target of this whole global debt trap. The idea is to bring them in line just as it is to bring us in line.
Oh, indeed. China is, I guess, the one country in the world that that really could challenge us economically at this stage, certainly not militarily, although China is no pushover. They're a nuclear power. But China is an economic juggernaut, still growing during this terrible economic period, maybe at half the rate or so that they did a few years ago. You never know. I'm certain they rigged their numbers just the way we rig ours, so you never know exactly what the real numbers are. But China? Go ahead, Ellen.
Apparently they do not feel that they're experiencing a credit crisis right now because they have these four big government-owned development banks which are pumping credit into internal development. So they're actually feeding money to their own people to build internally. They realize it was a mistake to become so dependent on foreign trade. And I read somewhere, for instance, they're making highways to nowhere in the way we used to build railroads out into the wilderness, because once you had a railroad, then people would go to the end of it and start developing or raising crops, and then because they had a way to ship them back to the big city. So far, people are using the roads to air their laundry on. It hasn't quite worked, but it's not the same as digging a hole. I mean, what they used to criticize Roosevelt for about just paying people to dig holes. You're actually laying an infrastructure or a foundation for greater development. And so that's putting the people to work. It's getting money out there. And so internally, they're doing fine. So we should do the same thing, and they should actually be glad for it. They should want us to do the same thing because we used to buy their products, and they want us to buy their products. And so you need to have the people have enough money to buy products. One thing that everybody, there are a lot of people who realize there's a problem, but they think that we need a very tight money system, like we need gold or something that can't expand. But what you leave out of that system is credit. Credit is a very important part of our money system, and in fact, that's the good thing that our banks have shown us. It's really the reason that America is on top
right,
right now.
We'll be right back, Ellen.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown. Ellen, I know it bothers you, and it sure bothers me that it really is not rocket science how to do things right as opposed to doing them so wrong the way we do them. And one other thing that I think is important to bring out is all of the money that we literally pour down a rat hole on military spending, and we have not had a single enemy anywhere in the world since the Japanese surrendered in August of 1945, just a day either before or after my birthday. And I remember it well back then, Ellen. I was hoping that they would sign that agreement on the Missouri on my birthday. So I would never, never forget the day World War II officially ended. But they didn't do it. Almost, but not quite. But we have not had an enemy since. The Cold War was really just to fuel the Pentagon. You got to scare people to get them to go along with spending all of this money on militarism for nothing. And it really is money down a rat hole, because you build roads and bridges and buildings, and that stuff stays. But what do you get by building all of these weapons and munitions and planes and tanks? They just rust out, and then you build new ones. So you build them to throw them away and replace them with others. And we've spent tens of trillions of dollars in the last 60-odd years. Now, just imagine if we took all of that money and we put it to productive domestic use. Think of the different kind of country we would have. Well, I want people to get mad. We don't need to spend this money now in the military. We may have 1,000 bases around the world. It is absolutely outrageous. There's no purpose for it. Oh, we want to control the world. That's the reason for it. But it doesn't do the people at home any good. Doesn't do us any good. Doesn't make us any less safe, any safer. It makes us less safe. We make enemies all over the world, including important ones like China and Russia, not to mention the entire Muslim world that absolutely detests us.
Well,
anyway.
Supposedly, the military is what is defending the dollar, that along with oil. And everybody's worried that now the dollar is not the only thing in which oil can be traded, that the dollar will collapse. But we don't need the military, and we don't need oil to defend the dollar. In fact, we don't need to defend the dollar. We could do everything internally. The way China became strong was that the world boycotted them, cut them off, and they turned inward, and they developed their own resources. Germany did the same thing in the 1930s when they were cut off, or they couldn't afford to pay their foreign debt, so they printed their own money and turned to internal development, and that worked. True, we may need some oil or whatever, but we can buy this stuff. It seems to me, some people said that we went into Iraq to get the oil, but that obviously wasn't true, because we could just buy the oil. What we may have gone into Iraq for was to turn their national bank and their national oil industry to get them privatized. And in fact, the central banks around the world have been privatized partly through military action, and well, originally through these debts that have been imposed on countries, and then if they don't pay, the military is liable to come in.
Oh, indeed, Ellen. I think one of the reasons we went into Iraq absolutely was not to have oil. Any country with oil wants to sell it, and anybody wants to buy it, they'll sell it to them. But we absolutely want to control oil. So we want to control the Middle East oil, the Caspian area oil.
I would say we want to control the banking system. That even more than oil, that's what they wanted to do, is to get everybody into this private central banking system. But that's the point. We don't need their private central banking system. And what we're defending is not what they're defending. I mean, we become identified with our Wall Street banks and our central bank, or the big bankers, the global bankers. But that's not us. The IMF is not us. We, the people of the United States, are being exploited just like everyone else is.
Oh, indeed. Everybody is exploited. The only way to get out from under it is to operate independently with government-run banks that can print money the way you describe, and that I wrote an article about based on what you taught me, Ellen. And, I mean, that system just works so beautifully. We can debate how many trillions we ought to be creating or are able to create, but you would agree, as you wrote in Web of Debt, such an incredible book. I want to put it up on Mount Rushmore or something or other. It's an incredible book, Ellen. It's a book that everybody should read. People who don't know it, reading your book, it will absolutely knock their socks off and shirt off and everything else, because it's so astonishing, and it all comes down to a system that really isn't all that complicated, and it works so beautifully, and you can go back historically the way you talk about it and show, well, it worked here, 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 and here, and even Adolf Hitler, for all the crimes that he committed, and what an absolute nightmare he brought to a good portion of this earth. I mean, the guy took a prostrate country. You can't imagine a country more prostrate than Germany. It was strip-mined of all its resources after the First World War. They had this terrible hyperinflation in the early 20s, and the country was broke, as you said, and they simply took control of their central bank, government-run, and they turned Germany into a prosperous country before they ever began to militarize. Oh my God! Any country can do that.
Mm-hmm. And it's people get the sense of that if you're going to print money, you're just going to inflate. But you don't have to print it. You can create it in the form of credit. In other words, credit is merely monetizing the thing you are about to create. Instead of thinking that in order to build something like a dam, you have to go find this pile of money first, and if you can't find the pile of money, you can't build the dam, you monetize the dam. In other words, you know that you're going to have a productive asset here, and you need so the community itself acknowledges that they want a dam, and so the community bank or the community credit or the full faith and credit of the United States is pledged against this asset that you're going to develop. So you write it up in your account by double entry bookkeeping. You put your dam up on one side, and you put the labor or the cost of building it on the other side. That's what Hitler did. He figured out how much it was going to cost to build these things he wanted to build, and he issued that many in marks and used those marks specifically, or they weren't marks, they were treasury certificates, but he used them specifically to pay for the things that he had designated them for, to build these things. So then once they're built, they say it's a dam, it's going to generate electricity. This is instead of selling it off to private investors, which is what we do every time we build something, so every time the government invests in something, as soon as it's done, we give it to private, we let it be privatized. But instead, if you kept that as a public asset, it would generate electricity, and the electricity would generate fees, which would come back to the government and pay off the loan. So it's not like you've created money that went out there and it never came back. The question is where you initiate the money. Instead of thinking that you have to go to this bank, which creates the money on its books anyway, it's not like the bank had it. They create credit just the same as the government could do itself. Well, why go to this private lender and pay it as much again as in interest as they gave us in principle when we can create that credit ourselves, essentially interest-free if you're the government? So you cut the cost of your project in half. You don't have this parasite that's bleeding all the profits off the top, and you've got an asset for the public.
It's such a beautiful system, Ellen. And along with all of this, let's say, infrastructure building that you're talking about now, you're putting people back to work. They're earning money. They're spending money. And the cycle just keeps going and going and going. And if you're creating prosperity and you're doing it right, it's self-sustaining. I mean, this stuff doesn't come. It's not a boom and then a bust. It can be very stable. It can keep going as long as you've got the right type of engine driving the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't. We have one that creates these ups and downs. The number that I mentioned yesterday, I think 19 recessions since the Fed came into existence, including the Great Depression. And who knows, maybe one day we'll look back and say two Great Depressions. But the jury is still out on that, so we'll have to wait and see.
And the reason they create depressions, it's a mathematical necessity that as long as you're always requiring more money to be paid back than you put out there, you create this bubble until it gets too big, and then it collapses. And it's a cycle. It's called the business cycle, as if there was something natural about it. But it's a cycle of what happens when you perpetuate a fraud. Eventually, the fraud is exposed, and it collapses, and then you start all over again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, something you build excesses. Our system is designed to build excesses and then crash, and then build excesses and then crash. And this last time, we built multiple excesses. We built several bubbles. The worst one of all, I guess, was the housing bubble. And I read some stuff as I began seeing that thing unravel. But a terrible housing bubble, and we may have had the granddaddy of all of them this time. that still keeps falling and falling every month. That seems to be the worst kind of bubble. But just imagine all the millions of people losing their homes, and how many millions more losing their homes. And then that creates, it hurts the economy. It causes job losses. So we're in this terrible contraction now. And I guess they're trying hard, Ellen, to inflate another bubble. And maybe they'll do it. But if they do it, somebody called it the bailout bubble.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they really inflate, if they have a bailout bubble and it makes the economy look like we're sort of getting back on track, then I think we're setting ourselves up for something much worse than if we just took the pain now and came back and got back on a more even keel. But I have to believe these people are doing it deliberately. They're not stupid. If you and I can talk about this stuff, they're not stupid. They know what they're doing. And I honestly believe, Ellen, that part of their scheme is to profit out of chaos. That maybe they've gone too far and they're worried about it, but if they can get the mechanism going the way they want it to go, then they can create this terrible chaos and be able to do things on the pretext that it's for our benefit, but it isn't. But be able to do those things that they never could do otherwise. Just after 9/11, we fought these two wars that are still going on. We put these terrible police state laws on the books, including the Patriot Act that was all written and ready to go, and it was passed 4 weeks after 9/11. It was impossible to pass it before 9/11. It's so awful. It revoked three or four of the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
But they got it right through, almost with unanimity in the Congress, or in the Senate, maybe a couple of votes against it in the Senate, and the House overwhelmingly. They never could have done this stuff. So they have this terrible event that happens, whatever it might be. So economically, you've got this terrible economic business going on. And out of this chaos, they're able to do stuff they couldn't do. And, of course, their ultimate aim is to control everything.
Mm-hmm. That's the legal premise that good cases make bad law. You take the extreme case, and everybody says, oh, yes, that's outrageous. We have to have a law against that. And then that, for instance, there's this three strikes law in California, which is about if you have three offenses, you wind up in jail for life or something like that. I don't remember.
Yeah,
three
terrible
felonies. And so they wind up getting people that have done marijuana or something. You know, I mean, it's something not all that threatening, and they wind up in jail for life. But the same thing's happening in the economic field, where that Financial Stability Board was just approved by us and everybody else, and it's got these amazing. It's got a very, very broad scope. They could make anything fall under these provisions, and their excuse for doing it is, well, the hedge funds need to be regulated, and everybody around the world, we have to all be on the same standards for regulating the hedge funds. Well, that sounds good, and you know, and CEO pay maybe is getting out of hand or something. I mean, they take the outrageous case. And they say, yep, we need global regulation here. And then they all approve this body, which has been around since 2000, and they had this obscure set of principles that they don't, principles and standards that you can just barely even find on the net that aren't defined at all, that include very broad things. Like, well, one that struck me was the structure and function of government. Well, that's our whole political system. Our whole way of life here is covered by this board that we just didn't elect, but just approved because it sounded like a good idea because of extreme things going on.
And this came out of the G20 meeting.
Yeah, right, the G20.
And again, we're talking about something involving global control,
yeah,
getting around national sovereignty.
Right.
I mean, this is very ugly stuff. And they deliberately write all this stuff in obscure language, so only they know what they're talking about. Like you've mentioned, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Anybody can read it and not have any idea what they plan to do.
Yeah, William Jennings Bryan, who passed the thing and actually got excited about it, was adamantly opposed to anything involving Wall Street bankers issuing our national currency. He said absolutely not. He was not going to approve any such thing when it was called the Aldrich Act. And then they changed the name to the Federal Reserve Act and pretended that they were making concessions to go along with what he wanted, and he said at last that people would be issuing their own currency, but they weren't. But you couldn't tell by reading the language.
Including having the U.S. Bureau of Engravings print the money.
Right, right. They print it. But
so the bankers control it, and they have a government agency roll the printing presses.
Right.
Oh, these people are devilishly clever. But and who's to know? When you finally understand their game, Ellen, it's already well on the way and it's too late. Well, I guess it's never too late if people get angry enough and demand things change. I mean, we could change the system now. If there was a mass rebellion in the country demanding it, they may have the tanks and planes, but we have the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. You know, outrage is a stage, and I mean, you need the outrage in order to. What I hope is that the outrage won't go to violent revolution, but it will be channeled into constructive mechanisms, political mechanisms. In California, we have the initiative and referendum. That's what I think we should do with a state bank. The problem is that it costs. I mean, a state-owned bank. I think we should have our own state-owned bank creating our own credit. But I was at the Democratic Convention, and I could see that the idea of actually getting legislators to take this idea and run with it was pretty remote. It wasn't going to happen. But if we had a political movement, we could force them to do it, or we could get it on the ballot, and then if people understood what it was, maybe we could get it passed. The problem is, it takes a lot of signatures, so many that you have to pay professional signature gatherers, and that's where the expense comes in.
Oh, absolutely. And the other way is if enough people go through enough pain for a long enough period of time, that can provoke change. Venezuela is my star example. And because things were so awful for so many years, it created Hugo Chavez. And their constitution was drafted for the people and put to a national referendum and voted on by the people who passed it. And if they want to change it, it goes to another referendum, and the people, not the legislators, have the say on stuff like that.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Oh, it's amazing, Ellen. We went through 2 hours, and I feel like we've just scratched the surface, and we need to just keep this thing going, which we will. But, there's so much to address. And, I guess I had on some months back Edward Herman, who has done such incredible work. He's getting well up in years now, I would guess late 70s, early 80s. But he's still writing, turning out material. And he once mentioned that what this country needs is a couple of left-wing billionaires. Well, unfortunately, anybody gets to that status, it may say they're left-wing, but they don't act left-wing. And I think one of the things he was thinking of was if we only had somebody on our side of the fence who owned one of the major TV networks to put on programming like this. And the only problem with that is it might run for a while. But then maybe that person and those around him or her would end up having an unfortunate accident.
Mm-hmm.
And then the right-wing folks would take it over again. That seems to happen with regularity when the wrong people get in the wrong positions. But it starts with people understanding what the devil is going on. Our government is not there to serve us. Our government is there to harm us, to take from us and give to the people who they really represent. And we need to change this, but it can only happen if enough people get upset enough and do it nonviolently, because that only produces more violence.
But it was a populist movement that got the Bank of North Dakota approved in 1919, and it was actually a left movement. I mean, originally it was a socialist movement, but they changed the name to the Nonpartisan League because it really was just a group of farmers fighting to preserve their farms. And, in fact, there's two movies on this. Originally, they couldn't get the farmers to join because these were Swedish farmers, very independent, and they weren't going to have anything to do with any kind of movement. But then when they saw that they were losing their farms right and left, they did finally join up. But, yeah, that's what it takes is public outrage. There is a movement afoot about the Federal Reserve, and there are people aware of the money issue, but they do tend to be on the far right. It's the libertarians who are sort of opposed to government in general. And there's almost no presence on the left. There's Dennis Kucinich, and that's pretty much it. But it really is a left issue. I mean, it's. I'm in favor of a public banking system. When you realize that all money is a medium of exchange, and that it's all based on credit, which is, all of our money now comes from credit. I mean, you can call it debt, but it's really credit. It's, you don't have the money now, but you want to build something, and so you borrow from this entity called a bank, which pretends to have the money, and then you pay them double for the privilege of paying it over time. When you realize that that's all our money system is, the natural overseer of this system would be the public itself. The community itself should be overseeing the issuance of the full faith and credit of the community. That's all you're drawing on is the credit of the community. You're going to give them these little papers and say, trust me that these things are good for what they say they're good for, and that I'm going to pay this back to this entity that trusted me with these little receipts out of the proceeds of the thing that I built. It was actually credit that our whole country was founded on and built on, and we actually have the banks to thank for that, and we really have the fractional reserve system to thank for that, because when the Constitution was written, the founding fathers were so afraid of the paper money that had actually gotten them through 100 years of colonial development and through the Revolutionary War, Continental had collapsed at the end of the Revolutionary War for reasons.
I got to cut you off, Ellen.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry.
They're going to cut us off, so I don't have any choice. Oh, it's such an important story. We will continue it the next time you come back. And whatever else is popping around that time, you never know.
Right.
You never know. We'll know more about the Bilderbergers and everything else going on. But, oh, another great hour, Ellen.
Okay, great time.
I can't wait to have you back on air again so we can continue this. And we will be back on Monday. We have a full slate next week. Terrific programming. Join us every day.